Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast.
Hi, this is Dick Stahl with another in our Journey series, interviews with thoughtful creatives and cultural influencers. Today, we continue our conversation with Annie Lamott. Now, you headed off to college and you went through a Jewish phase.
I didn't go through a Jewish phase. I think I didn't write that section very well in the book is what happened, because I never actually went through a Jewish phase, although I can see why you think that, since I had a bas mitzvah. Oh, that's what's making you think that I had a Jewish phase. Well, I'd always...
Well, but you were very attracted to...
I have always really loved Jews. I had always felt that it was such an exciting cultural and familial way to grow up. And so when I went to college, which I did very briefly, just for several hours when I was 17. No, I went for 2 years. But all the really cool girls, I went to a women's college, Goucher, were Jews. And and I wanted to be like them, and I wanted what they had, which was this wonderful warmth and this intellectual aliveness and these wonderful senses of humor. And so while I was at Goucher, I think it was my sophomore year, and I was 18, I had this philosophy teacher named Eva Gossman, and she took us through Fear and Trembling. I almost said Fear and Loathing, which is Hunter Thompson. It was Fear and Trembling. And I had an experience in her class where, when she told us about Abraham's leap of faith, when he is instructed by this Old Testament God to take Isaac up on the mountain and kill him, I understood something of what he must have been grokking, to use that old 60s term, that without God, without the promises of God, he was so doomed anyway that it was just a matter of time till his kid died, no matter how you cut it, and so that he was going to decide to step over the abyss of doubt and self-loathing into the promise of God, which was that Isaac was going to give him many descendants. Yeah. He asked him to take him up to the mountain and to sacrifice him, and he told him, or his angels told him, in the next breath, that Isaac would give him many descendants. So he told him to, he asked him to believe a paradox. And Abraham said, okay.
What was the professor's purpose in introducing Kierkegaard? The professor probably did not intend that you would take it the direction that you did necessarily.
Well, I think that, like a lot of good teachers, they don't intend that you take it anywhere. They don't try to get you to come into some prearranged way of thinking or seeing the world. But instead, she was trying to give us the writing, you know, and it was Heidegger and Nietzsche and all the stuff that had blown her away, that had made her think about things and see the world in a really, really different way, and had made her confront stuff and get to find out what she actually made of it all. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the Kierkegaard was a part of that, that he's such a beautiful writer, for one thing. I mean,
well, and it's not surprising that he would end up in your pathway somewhere, because he was one that was kind of railing against the Christianity of his day and railing against the irrelevancy of the culture and trying to work his way towards an authentic relationship with God that he didn't see really anywhere.
Right.
And so his own kind of way of dealing with these texts has an authenticity that attracts people who are not necessarily interested in being seduced
right.
into the faith.
Yeah.
But there's kind of an intellectual seduction I don't know that he would have viewed it as seduction, although he was very comfortable with the notion of people working their way through the intellectual problems and finding themselves at kind of the relational level with God.
But also you had a sense of how troubled and awed he felt, and how really bereft a place he was coming from. He didn't have a single easy answer. He didn't have like grace light that he was trying to fob off on you. He had really felt a lot of the same things I had felt, which was this profound anxiety and a really deep sense of grief and confusion about what things meant and where you found your where you could find a home and all that. He was very heavily involved in social justice matters. He had really radicalized a very large congregation of very wealthy people in Belvedere, which is where his church was. He had gotten them thinking about the message of Jesus, which was really not that we get, you know, pull up the ladder, I got mine, and you know, we can have this and most people can't. But instead, the message of Jesus, which was that you were just loved and that you were cared for, Jesus didn't come and say, look, would everybody who's doing really, really well, please come with me, you know, and everyone who's doing fine financially and emotionally, please, I want you. He said, I want the people who are nuts, and I want the people who are nobodies, and I want the women. And I'm not just going to include the women, I'm going to look to the women.
And this appealed to you.
Well, this was so
especially the
profound.
Part about the nuts part.
And the nuts part, and I was just I was a lunatic at that point. I mean, I always had my surface together. I was always funny and loving and, you know, very codependent. So I had a lot of friends. I was born and raised in the same county I still live in. I mean, I don't travel well at all. And so I had this kind of webbing around me of relatives and very, very old friends. But my insides were going bad. I was just nuts. I was not okay again. I was scared a lot of the time, and I just was depressed, and I couldn't figure out, and I believed in God, but at the point I went to see Rankin, as I wrote about in that book, I couldn't believe God could love someone like me. I thought, what kind of God does not draw the line somewhere? And he said, God has to love you, that's God's job. And I was saying, well, does it say that somewhere? You know, are you sure? And he said, yeah, it says it at lots of places.
Now, you also began doing something kind of interesting, which was you began kind of dropping in the background of St. Andrew.
Yes, that was later,
church.
Though. Yeah, so then that was several years later when I was living over in a houseboat community. It was right across the street from this gigantic flea market. And I used to go there because I loved junky food when I was hungover, which I was almost all the time. And I love greasy food that'll just slide down. Of course, I love it now, and I've been sober 13 years. I don't have a good diet. But anyway, so I'd go there, and I'd hear this music wafting over. And it was really beautiful. It was a little Presbyterian church, about a little bit more black than white, but really integrated, very Baptist in its feel, because a lot of the old women were African Americans from the South, and they brought that tradition of worship. And I loved the music, and I always left before the Jesus-y part got too intense, you know, like the sermon or the scripture, because I thought it was like believing in extraterrestrials, or which I guess it kind of is. It was so beyond anything I was willing to even hear.
But what attracted you?
The music, the friendliness, the fact that they let me be there when, and they told me to come back, and a lot of people weren't saying that I should come back anytime soon at that point. And they didn't crowd me, you know, I have this kind of Soviet airspace that I like people to observe, and they didn't come on to me, they didn't try to get me to sign up, they didn't try to get me to sign on the dotted line, they just let me be there. And it was warm, and it was friendly, and I felt safe. I felt like it was a harbor, and I would go there so that I could stop being so rocky. And then eventually, when I felt that I was going to end up being a Christian, because I started to be aware of Jesus, I was able to finally tolerate the sermons.
Join us for our next podcast with Annie Lamott. Thank you for listening to Journeys on the Kindling's Muse.